The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, there are so many signals right now coming out that seem to be real, that our senses and our gut feeling and actually our training tells us that it's wrong, but it still feels real. I'm talking about the market, talking about the talk of recovery, talking about what's happening in Washington right now, where Congress is completely unnecessary for the direction we're going.
Well, and we have so many things in the mix. It's worth looking at your fundamentals. I mean, this is really what you must do, is focus on fact and not on fiction.
Right.
The fictional view of the market is that we are in recovery. Why do we say it's fictional? Well, I mean, look at a few facts. One, we have deficit spending. If you look at our total gross domestic product, this is the totality of our economy. It's about $16 trillion.
Right.
Government deficit spending is $1 trillion. That's about 6.25% of our total number.
So that's not real productivity. That's just borrowing into the ether.
It keeps us feeling like we are doing just fine. But the reality is we're on some sense of life support. We have zero interest rate policy here and frankly all around the world. And this is again something that creates a reality, but it's not actually a reality. There's not real economic activity happening, even though there is massive credit creation. There is no real economic activity that's improving in the economy. And this is one of the things that we see as we talk to people all across the country, the sense of frustration that, yes, they have a rise in prices and living on a fixed income, they're not able to meet their needs, which drives them into taking more risks in their investment to fill the gap. They have to do something to meet their income needs. And they are told at the same time that there is no inflation. They are told that it is tame, that it is controlled. The Fed, actually, Ben Bernanke thinks it is well anchored. We don't have inflation today. That's not a concern.
Well, I'll tell you, Dave, it reminds me of navigation. Okay, you've had some flying experience. I've got my pilot's license. And, you know, you look at the accident reports, and oftentimes the reason a person will crash is they're trusting the wrong signals. Now, navigation is an interesting way of making an analogy here as you walk through investment life, because what you're doing is you're setting on a particular course and you're getting a lot of false signals while you're navigating. I'll use flying as an example. JFK Jr., when he crashed, he did not trust his instruments. He trusted his feelings instead. And actually, they think he fixated on a particular star, thinking it was the horizon, ended up stalling the plane, and unfortunately, tragically.
So even though he had the training to trust his instruments, he was going with something that he considered to be more valid at the moment. How he felt and what his instincts were telling him. Now, this is where you have to come back to facts.
Right.
You have to come back to things that are rooted and grounded. The realities. What do you know? What do you remember? What did you learn? What was your training? This, I think, is imperative. As I look back at what I've learned from my father,
right.
This is where, you know, if I have an instinct, it's not a feeling. It is a training process that I've been through to look at things that are of fundamental value, to look at things as basic as supply and demand, to understand that the movement of money, the movement of credit, the impact of credit in a given economy, the expansion or contraction of credit, these vital and very basic, even mundane or boring things, when you look at them, when you weigh them, frankly, what you feel is irrelevant.
Well, and actually, that's why you're trained in the first place. The reason your father passed that on to you, and you're going to pass on to, you know, your kids, is because the feeling does not necessarily match the correct action. You know, I think of a book that I had been reading called The Last Navigator, about the last Polynesian navigator before he shared his knowledge, to the Western world. Before that, all knowledge in Polynesian navigation was passed down from grandfather to father to son. And here's what Pialog said about navigation. He said, to navigate, you must be brave. And to be brave, you must remember. If I'm brave, it's because I remember the words of my fathers. When I voyage, I forget everything else and think only of my grandfather, father, and what my master taught me. Then I'm not afraid. Because you get a lot of false signals, especially, Dave, let's say you get out in the middle of the ocean. You don't have a compass. You don't have a sextant. This is Polynesian navigation. You've got a sail. That's it. You're out there. You can't see a thing, and you got to find an island hundreds of miles away.
Hopefully you can see the stars. If you can't, you can certainly feel the currents and the water and the change of the waves and what you see in terms of the changing dynamics there. It tells you something. What does it tell you? What do you know on the basis of fact, and what will your actions be? How will they be directed in light of that?
So, David, if I'm a person who doesn't believe the stock market should be where it is right now, if I'm a person that does not believe that the economy is actually recovering and that we're actually borrowing our way into just padding over it, what do I do?
Well, and I think this is where, again, you have to be aware of false signals, where if you're following the wrong signals, you need to return to what the right signals are.
Right.
And here's the problem. In the markets today, we have the granddaddy of them all in terms of false signals.
Mm-hmm.
Fed rate policy was really the standard bearer when Alan Greenspan moved rates to 1% to accommodate a very fragile economy and stimulate growth. Now, that was in the Greenspan era.
Right.
His protege, Mr. Bernanke, has taken it a step further and demonstrated to the world how now, it seems, uncontroversial these policies are. What once was controversial is now uncontroversial.
Printing money, zero interest rate policy, that's all. That's not controversial anymore because it works.
What we really need to get to the point where we can say, yes, we have recovered, is to have sort of an after-game analysis.
Hmm.
An after-game analysis to see if we really agree with that. We see the game at halftime. And we haven't gone far enough to know if these policies, again, they've transitioned from being controversial to now uncontroversial, but the game's not over. We can't really weigh in as to whether or not they are successful or not.
Well, and you know, the crazy thing about Bernanke right now, like with Alan Greenspan, we're not living in a bubble, Dave. It's not the United States just isolated doing our own policies. We're starting to see copycat killing of currency.
Well, and that's what we're really talking about here, because Alan Greenspan once was a standalone standard bearer,
right.
But Bernanke has morphed from the head of the world's largest central bank to the global central bank choir master.
Mm.
And as he experiments and breaks new ground, again, non-conventional becomes conventional monetary policy, not just in the United States, but the world over.
There's
Here's
central banks overseas right now that are doing the same thing.
Well, how many central banks are there running a low to negative rate policy at present?
What are there? 10, 15?
3, 7, no, 40 in total.
40 worldwide central 40 banks.
40 central banks are in harmony.
Copying Bernanke.
With Ben Bernanke, and now believing the course that they are on is the best, if not the only course, even if there are a few side effects.
Well, and Dave, you know, what are the side effects of central bank printing? I mean, John Williams is a regular guest of ours, and he calls for it. He says, you know, you cannot print money, ultimately, without having inflation.
Well, it affects almost every asset class. When you manipulate rates lower, you alter the yield curve at the short end, which eventually alters the yield curve in total.
Okay.
Long-term and your short-term bonds, their prices change and their interest rates change as well, being the other side of that equation. And it doesn't end there. By lowering rates, you create cheap money.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the distribution of that said money is uneven. So you create cheap money, you don't necessarily know where it's going to go, but we see signs today of huge leverage buyouts and of money. Again, you make cheap money and it's going to go somewhere. It has to find a home. We've got private equity deals. I mentioned the LBOs, where debt financing is a key component. And again, this is just one example of you create too much cheap money and it has to find a home.
Well, and you know, what we've talked about before, the person who really does need to rely on interest, your older retired person, your pensioner, those people right now are being forced into speculation for those same reasons, the low rates.
Well, and frankly, whether it is someone living on a fixed income looking to supplement their income or someone who's doing an leveraged buyout deal, you're talking about paying a price, and in most instances, when you have money that's cheap, the price of the asset in question gets distorted, and you're usually paying too much for the asset.
So speculation increases, which increases the price.
Well, exactly. So you've got greater levels of speculation in riskier assets, again, a consequence of lowering rates. Why and how? I mean, again, investors are either primarily geared towards growth, or as an alternative, they're geared towards income. And income in a low-rate environment can only be met by increasing risk. That's where the higher yields still exist. So the entire fixed income field is shifted in the process, and risks are largely ignored in order to achieve that primary need, more cash flow, to supplement daily living requirements.
Well, David, if you would watch the news media right now, they're all smiles. They're saying recovery, recovery, recovery. We're going to have growth this year. But we're already seeing cuts in that estimated growth.
But what you're seeing is a movement in the markets, not necessarily a movement in the real economy.
Right.
That's where you're not really in good shape. The real economy is not in good shape. The markets are in good shape. Why? Because of price. We don't think they're in good shape because of value. But price, certainly, you can't argue with 14,000 on the Dow. That's a lot better than 13 or 12 or 10. But again, how did you get there and is it sustainable? That's where we would return to the real economy to determine whether or not it is a sustainable course. The CBO slashed its long-term growth estimates from 3% to 1.9% per year, and we see that as closer to the reality. Frankly, 1 to 1.5% growth rates are where we would be comfortable saying, okay, they can engineer that. This is the problem. You can engineer it, but it does cover over two very important variables. Recall that if you distort the inflation gauge in the GDP statistic, that's called the deflator, if you distort that inflation gauge, then you overstate GDP growth figures. So in all reality, your 1 to 1.5% engineered number is actually a 0% number by the time you factor in the deflator.
And that's just the deflator. We're not talking about borrowed money.
Right. Well, it doesn't end there. You're right. GDP is the all-in number for economic activity. You've got $16 trillion in activity. That's what we talked about earlier. You've got a trillion of that, which is spending from the government, and they're using borrowed cash. Again, that's deficit spending, not just government spending, but government deficit spending, money they don't have. And, you know, if you really want an honest-to-goodness, where does the rubber meet the road idea of economic viability here in our economy, what you have to do is take out that government deficit spending from the GDP figure and realize that that 6.25% contribution to GDP, again, the trillion, represents 6.25% of our GDP. Without that, you're in depression territory.
So we're shrinking. We're losing 5% a year. We're not growing.
Well, this is the point. And so, again, you come back to your signals and what the economy is telling you, what it's not telling you. Be careful. Be careful of stepping too far out onto the limb. The mass media paints a very easy sell-side view of the world, which is things are in recovery. We have nothing to worry about. Look at central bank activity. It's healthy. It's bringing us back on track. It's the Draghi promise. It's the Ben Bernanke put. We've got the wind in our sales, and this is again where we would say, well, listen, this is not exactly recovery. This still describes a life support scenario.
Right.
And this is why we've long argued that if real economic activity doesn't pick up and doesn't replace that government contribution of 6.25% of GDP, then we are, as previously suggested, on life support.
Well,
stabilized,
you know,
but we're not in recovery.
That's a great analogy, Dave. You've used life support in the past. We've had guests talk about the same thing. But, you know, if you've got a patient in the hospital that's hooked up to a bunch of machines and a lot of drips, they may look just fine laying there in bed, but they're still on life support. Okay, they're not obviously able to get up, walk out of the hospital, and maintain that same degree of health without it.
Right. No, it really is the question of you check a patient into the ER, and if they've been moved to a recovery room, that's fine. But if they're still in the intensive care unit,
right,
you may have stabilized the patient, but again, how far down the road to recovery are you? You haven't even moved rooms yet. Now, you kind of have an indication when you've moved on from your basic supports that person is past the point of critical detriment, where something bad could still happen to them, and they need to be monitored minute by minute.
Right.
That really is where we're at. When you look at zero interest rates, the zero interest rate policy that we've set, that 40 other central banks around the world have set, this is life support. This is life support. This is not normal. And all you have to do is look at a chart. We did this when we were at our last two conferences down in Orlando and in Phoenix. We looked at the Fed funds rate going back to 1940. And what you have is the Fed moving the rate constantly in light of their economic inputs to accommodate, to add a little bit more heat if they need it, or cool it off a little bit, the economy, if they need to. And what we've had now for almost 2 years is the same thing. And it actually looks like what you get when a patient is dead, a flat line, just beep. And this is the reality, not only with us, but 40 other central banks. This is not recovery. This is dependence on credit at a level we've never seen before, even in the Great Depression, frankly.
Well, and this dependence on credit, you would think that the gold market would just be exploding. You know, this is, the gold market feels tired. It always does. Toward the end of a consolidation, it feels tired. But what's amazing is the gold market, as it slipped last week, okay, and we saw it slip some, at that same time, we were seeing reports come out of Russia that Putin was buying more gold than China, and
right.
China was buying more gold than they ever had.
Well, and this is where we turn our attention to the gold market. Of course, we've had several weeks of slippage. And go back in time a little bit. There was a mid-August Gallup poll. Now, this is August 2011.
Right.
So roll the clock back. And it showed that 34% of those polled thought that gold was the best long-term investment, nearly twice the number that were interested or pursuing equities.
Well, no, wait. August 2011, 34% thought it was the best investment.
Yeah,
that was the month we hit the high.
Well, or within days.
Yeah.
You know, you could say within a 30-day window, gold put in an all-time high at 1920.
Right.
And this is really the point. Sentiment follows price.
So, Dave, when the shoeshine boy does like gold, that's a time maybe that you want to settle back and let it give you a better price.
Maybe you want to be cautious. As many a successful investor will tell you, sentiment is a dangerous guide
right.
for investing. How you feel about something is almost never reflective of reality when it comes to investing. Now, listen, feelings may have a very strong role to play in the rest of your life. But when it comes to investing, I can tell you the difference between greed and fear, you will be played the fool. You are the patsy if you allow your emotions to speak in the investment process. I'm telling you, that is where the patsy is played and plays a vital part in the market. People win and people lose, but the losers are the ones who are determining their course according to their emotions and not the facts.
So when you're writing poetry, you can go ahead and tap into the heat of emotion, but you want to be cold, calculating, and remember your basics when you're investing.
Right. So that issue of price action, when prices are moving higher, regardless of the asset in question, I mean, this is not just gold, this could be equities, this could be real estate, it could be anything. When the price of an asset is moving higher, there is a self-reinforcing enthusiasm. And it's often distanced from the fact. And this we have had in spades today, but on the opposite end of the emotional spectrum. So when it comes to gold, yes, 17 months of a price consolidation, and it's wearing on investor sentiment. And if the Gallup poll was taken today, rather than 34% thinking that it was the best thing since sliced bread, what you'd probably see is 30 to 50% enthusiasm for stocks. Why? Well, listen, 14,000 on the Dow. You can't argue with that. Let's
right.
get in. Let's go all in. And in fact, guess what, Kevin? Just here in the last 30 days, we finally begin to see the needle move a little bit. We finally begin to see the average individual investor start buying equity mutual funds again. Timing couldn't be better. Tell me investors aren't driven by their emotions. Tell me price action isn't self-reinforcing in terms of the feel of the market and what people do. I'm telling you, Kevin, people do the wrong thing at the wrong time.
Dave, you know, it cracked me up when you were in Phoenix. Okay. I got a USA Today every day at the hotel for free. Okay. And the headline in the money section of USA Today talked about reasons to buy the stock market. And it said investor sentiment has not been this high since 2007.
No, that's a reason to sell the market.
What happened after 2007?
Well, exactly. But that's how the general public translates the data.
Right.
Investor sentiment hasn't been this high. I will tell you, when investor sentiment is high with any asset class, be cautious.
Right.
If investor sentiment is high for gold, you probably don't want to be a buyer on a temporary basis. If the fundamentals are still supportive, you may want to own it, but you certainly don't want to add to a position if it's moving at a fever pitch in the market.
Right.
Do we have that right now? No. In fact, you've got people making the mistaken step of assuming that gold is not desirable given its current price level. I mean, nothing could be further from the truth. That range of $1,550 to $1,650 is an ideal range to be purchasing gold. Investors usually work against themselves by prioritizing their feelings over the things that they know. And frankly, I don't know if this is self-doubt in the investment process. That may be what's common. Or it may be just that they're not reviewing the facts and they begin to move in the wrong direction at the wrong time.
Well, and David, you know, we've talked in the past about looking at the chart, the gold chart for the last 12 years. And what you see is three consolidations, now a fourth, where it will go sideways. The line will go sideways for about 15 to 17 months. That 1550 to 1650 range is that sideways line. And that always represents, after a consolidation, the lowest price you could have purchased.
And if you can buy it at the low end of the range, you're better for it 6, 12, 18 months out. So allow the consolidation to run its course. Double check and make sure that the fundamentals are still supportive.
Right.
And that you should still own the asset class in question to a large degree. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Keep on looking at the instruments, but your feelings may tell you something very different. In fact, in the right environment, I've been in a plane before where I was getting dizzy because I wasn't sure what was happening. Why? There was so much cloud cover, I couldn't tell if we were turning left, banking right, going up, going down. My body was confused.
Right.
And not being the pilot, I didn't have the instruments to tell me that I was either doing the right thing, the wrong thing, going the right direction, going the wrong direction.
Well, David, not just checking the instruments yourself, itself. But one of the things, you know, the Bible says there's wisdom in a multitude of counselors, and you need to check a broad range of opinions. You know, Barron's does that with the round table. We've talked to several of those guys on this commentary, Zuloff, Mark Faber. We're going to have Mark on in a couple of weeks.
Right. Well, in this Barron's round table, I would suggest that all of our listeners get the last couple of copies of Barron's and look through it, because you get a broad spectrum of people who are generally permabulls on equities, and they still are permabulls in equities. And then you've got folks that, depending on what is happening in the market, will be bullish or bearish, and that's where you begin to see some divergence. Actually, Mark Faber couldn't make it this year, but as you mentioned, another one of our weekly commentary contributors, Felix Zuloff, is a well-regarded Swiss banker. He sees gold ownership now as an imperative, and those sentiments were also echoed by Fred Hickey. He's a part of the group, and most notably, Bill Gross.
Bill Gross, the bond king.
Well, that makes his suggestion that much more curious, because in the world of bonds, if you buy the asset correctly, if you buy a bond cheap at a discount, you've bought it correctly. If you've bought the right credit, or you understood the credit structure of that particular issue, you may have an advantage and have eliminated a number of the risk variables in the purchase. One variable that you're really not in control of, and subject to, a risk factor for the bondholder, is rising inflation.
Right.
This is what's very curious. You've got a bond guy suggesting gold as his first purchase, the most important purchase that you can consider.
Of 2013.
And because these guys, what they do is they make their recommendations for the year. And
right.
At the end of the year, they, you know, do sort of a scorecard to see, well, how'd you do? You know, for a bond guy to be suggesting that you need to own gold, one of the smartest guys in the fixed income universe, and he's concurring with our thinking that when you put the world's central bankers on task to inflate as it were, and generate economic activity via credit creation, yes, you ultimately get inflation.
You don't need John Williams for that, but
no,
John would tell you that.
And that's what's being baked into the cake.
Yeah.
You see, the facts are actually quite simple. Britain is still in recession.
Mm-hmm.
The Eurozone is not yet on the road to recovery. China, well, hey, actually, China looks great, but only because the 2012 declining growth trend scared leadership, and that's leadership in transition, into ramping up credit creation. We're talking about $400 billion worth of credit creation in January alone for an economy that's smaller than ours.
This is
a lot of money in credit.
That's that copycat killing I'm talking about, the copycat killing of currencies. Okay, maybe Bernanke started it, or Greenspan started it, whoever. But you've got even China doing it now.
Well, but then there's the U.S. You can call it a recovery, but frankly, we're not there yet. In a recovery, you rarely need life support, which is what the credit markets and economy have via the steady flow of cheap credit from the Fed. Take that away, and you have a deflationary-style collapse.
But, David, even if we were just looking at supply and demand fundamentals, let's pretend like we're not talking about gold here. We're just talking about soybeans or wheat or whatever. You have to look and say, okay, how much is being produced? How much is being consumed? And even taking all the inflation out of the picture, it still paints a rosy picture for gold.
Right. You've got buyers and sellers on the one hand, and then you've got the question of how much product is available. So supply is a variable. Demand is a variable. And I think that's one of the things that is most supportive at this point. Demand, on a value basis, increased last year to an all-time high. $236.4 billion came into the gold market. $236.4 billion. Now, that's even as tonnage slipped by 4% from 2011 numbers. Mm-hmm. So, again, you can expect to see a decline in tonnage demand with an increase in price. Now, digging into that a little bit, the area of greatest strength came from institutional investors and central banks. Central banks, according to the GFMS group, added a net 536 tons for the year. That is 4 years running of adding tonnage. Now, remember, the trend was for 25 years prior to that, net liquidations from your central banks. That changed in 2009. A part of the subdued gold price in the 90s was because of central bank dumping of gold onto the market. That was, of course, the Western world's central banks, the developed world's central banks.
Mm.
It's not the case today. It is the Eastern world, it is the developing world central banks that are moving into gold. They're moving in the opposite direction today, and that's where a lot of your demand is coming from.
So your big money, what we're talking about is countries, central banks. It's money that actually is very, very inside, because not only are they insiders, they're creators of money, but they're actually accumulating more gold than anybody right now.
And you've got new entrants into the gold market, central banks that have never really participated much. Brazil added a lot of tons in the last quarter this last year, along with Paraguay. So your Latin American countries are jumping on board in ways that they haven't for a long time.
And when you say added, we're talking about added demand.
Oh, exactly. They're buying tons. I mean, the Paraguayan government bought 7.5 tons of gold. Again, relative to what we have in the U.S. of over 8,000, it seems like small potatoes. But unless you've been to Paraguay, that's a small country. It's a small economy, and that was a big purchase. And Brazil's adding now, too, 20, 30 tons at a time.
Well, you know, simple economics. You don't have to be a college graduate of economics to know that if demand is constant and supply is decreasing, the price is going to increase.
Well, what about supply side, then? Because you had the totals for this year, which actually declined. Supplies of gold declined by 1.4%. This is for 2012. The total was 4,453 tons. That was the total. And, of course, that combines both mine supply and recycled gold. The notable decrease came from recycled gold. That's really important to me because it's the only elastic source. In other
words,
it's the only...
You're talking bangles and boggles and
you're
talking about jewelry.
Talking about jewelry when someone says it's out of date, I'm not going to wear it, it's been sitting in the safety deposit box, I want to keep my second car payment going. For whatever reason, you end up monetizing it.
Right.
You sell it, you melt it down, the We Buy Gold stores all over the country. Now, it's very interesting. The World Gold Council suggests that the industrialized world, while they've been contributing sizably to the recycled gold area, they are considerably depleted and in a declining trend from this point forward. So there may be a case that the non-industrialized world will continue to sell gold into the recycled part of that component. But no, in terms of the industrialized world, kind of on a one-and-done basis, they have already melted down most of the gold that they wanted to keep that second car payment going, to make sure that they paid rent, et cetera, et cetera. Mine supplies, again, going back to mine supplies, they increased in contrast to the recycled gold, which actually decreased. Mine supplies increased in China and Russia. They slipped yet again in South Africa and Indonesia. And again, I think this is where we look and say, you can't just decide that you want to increase by 1,000 tons a year what's coming from mines.
Right.
They're running a full tilt effort and are lucky to get what they are getting. They can't find any new major ore bodies. The new major ore bodies that they're finding actually aren't that major and are either in politically compromised places or are hung up with the EPA to date.
Well, and you know, you brought up China and Russia, which not only are they producing so much, but they're buying more than anybody, like we talked about before. So in reality, they're not making much of an impact on supply worldwide because they're just keeping it.
Well, exactly. So it's not coming to market, in other words. So yeah, what we have is very price positive as we move into 2014, 2015 and beyond, is this recycled gold component coming down. Now it's 16.25. We'll see. Maybe it bumps up this year if we see a move up higher in gold, if we get closer to 2,000 an ounce. Maybe we see a resurgence in supplies from the recycled market. But the view of GFMS and out of London and the World Gold Council is that in this period, 2012-2013, we see the recycled component peak. And they argue for a peak gold scenario, in fact, where we just don't have enough gold to keep up with demand. And again, this is what I think is very, very healthy to look at. We have very healthy demand dynamics, mm-hmm. and yet we have had the price of gold drop since the beginning of the year. If you have healthy demand, how can you possibly have the price dropping? Look at one thing, backwardation. Today, you have gold in backwardation, or you have in recent weeks. And essentially, what that implies is that your physical market is actually quite strong. Backwardation is when your front months, in terms of your futures contracts, are selling at a premium compared to future months, which are selling at a discount, which is the exact opposite of what normally happens. Because when you lock in a futures contract in the future, the farther out you go, you have to factor in the time value of money. And this is actually working the exact opposite, where you're paying a premium up front, but there's a discount in the future.
Right.
That backwardation process does imply that the physical market is very strong. It also, on a secondary basis, implies that the futures market is being abused in terms of manipulation as you move into those longer dated futures contracts. There's less volume, it's easier to do, and you're seeing a price driven down by this manipulative tendency. How long does it last? Not very long. But can it be discouraging the process? Sure. What you as an investor need to hold on to is the fundamentals. What is on your side? Okay, 40 of the world's central banks are printing like mad, or let's put it more accurately, they're creating credit like mad. And then on top of that, you've got a supply and demand equation which is in balance. And it doesn't take either much of a supply drop or demand increase to see the prices move positively again.
So basically what we're seeing is, if we're looking at the dashboard, since we were talking about, you know, the cockpit, so to speak, and we're feeling something different coming from the press, coming from the prices in the stock market, people need to just understand the fundamentals. I'm glad you brought up backwardation, because actually the precious metals market, along with all the commodities markets, are traded on leverage, on paper. You know, that paper outnumbers the amount of ounces in gold that's traded on paper versus what is actually in real life.
Oftentimes 100-to-1.
It's crazy.
So what happens in the paper world impacts the physical world, even though the physical world is really the telltale in terms of the strength of the market.
Well, Dave, then we may be sharing company secrets, but I think you better share what you've shared with all of us, because there is a supply squeeze right now coming in the physical markets. We, as a precious metals company that's been around for 40 years, is having a terrible time getting gold in Europe right now and
in the United States. I would say that compared to what we can usually go out and buy, we're at probably 25% or 30% levels. In other words, if ordinarily we could buy anything we wanted, we can only buy about 25% or 30% of that today. And that's in the U.S. market, that's in the international market. There is more and more constraint on the supply side, the physical supply side, even as prices are dropping. And again,
right,
for a novice investor, you scratch your head and say, how is this possible? It looks like mass liquidation. It looks like we're moving into a bear market in gold. What is happening? And I can tell you, again, go back to that issue of backwardation. You've got some manipulation in the farther contracts.
Right.
Fine. That's a temporary phenomenon. Backwardation doesn't last very long.
Well, and let them do it. It makes the real stuff cheaper.
I'm not bothered by it.
Yeah.
Except that I'd like a few more dollars to put into silver below 30,
yeah,
and a few more dollars to put into gold below 1600. That's great. This band between 1550 and 1650, if you're on the fence,
yeah,
what the heck are you doing there?
Right.
I mean, if you want to shave pennies here and there and say, well, you know, just for bragging rights, fine, save a few dollars, save a few shekels to buy at 1565 precisely, or 1580 precisely, or 1554 precisely. I mean, pick your number. But honestly, you may not get your number. So just do the smart thing and buy value. Then this is where we see, again, going back to that distortion of value. If you look at what the Fed has done to manipulate prices, the stock market is a manipulated market today. Why?
Right.
It doesn't reflect reality. It doesn't reflect economic activity. It reflects money printing. It reflects easy money policies the world over. It reflects a hyped emotional state within the market, which frankly is very frail and can turn on a dime.
Yeah, it never lasts. It never lasts. Unless it's fundamentally supported. You know, I think of silver too, though, Dave. Silver almost hit $50, okay, a couple of years ago, and now we're back down in that 30 range, or even a little shy of 30. I mean, that too would be a buy, would it not?
I would say anything under 33 is a buy.
Yeah.
Anything under 33, if you look at the long-term growth projections that we have, both, again, supply and demand fundamentals, as well as its relationship to gold. We're talking about industrial uses, as well as a monetary characteristic, which it has taken on and will continue to take on in future years. We see 33 and below as absolutely vital. I think, frankly, it's a compelling story. 30 is mandatory on silver. Under 30 is mandatory. Find it. Go find some money and buy silver under $30. Gold, yeah, under 1600? Are you kidding me?
Right.
But you've got amongst these top big banks huge derivative positions. Huge derivative positions. And they assume they've got the tiger by the tail.
Well, and David, I remember 1987. I remember the exuberance in 1987. And you know, the reason I bring that up is that was my first year that your dad hired me. Okay. Back in 1987, the stock market, ultimately, most people remember, crashed in October, but it didn't look like that ahead of time. I mean,
No. In fact, there was exuberance in the market at the time. And a part of that exuberance came from a newly popular way. It had been around for a while, but it had just been popularized, a way of hedging risk in your portfolio. It was called portfolio insurance.
Right.
We call it something else today. We don't call it portfolio insurance. We today call it derivatives. But at that point, if you looked at all of the portfolio insurance that had been purchased, it was valued at roughly 2% of market capitalization. The total stock market compared to the insurance that had been bought for those positions, 2% of market capitalization.
It was a minor position. I mean, it could completely go away, and it still would only affect 2%.
And there was this boldness. The market was ripping forward because they had this extra cushion, if you will.
Right.
If you begin to see a loss, we've covered that by having this insurance policy. Well, we wonder, with record year-end margin borrowing, and again, if you look at December 31st, where equity margin borrowing was, it was the highest levels on record at year end. We've seen higher levels intra year, but at a year end number, this was the highest we've seen on record. We wonder if with year end margin borrowing being at those levels and a derivatives market, which is not 2% of market capitalization, but today the equivalent of 13.5 times market capitalization, we wonder if we're not moving towards a collapse in the market. Why? Because on the one hand, you've got incredible confidence.
Right.
On the one hand, you've got the world central bankers who are on an experimental basis, assuming that they have it all figured out, and yet we're only at halftime. And we know there's a lot that can change in the second half. We know there's a lot that can change in the second half. And that's where we're concerned, with leverage being this high, with mutual funds being all in and cash balances basically being zero, with sentiment amongst the Wall Street professionals being frothy, with bears being dead or in deep hibernation, you know, moving below that 25% level. Bears are non-existent today.
Right.
Major turns in the market are highly probable this year, and investors need to proceed with incredible caution.
Well, and not only caution, but courage, like we talked about before. If you have to courageously follow what you think is right, even if you're hearing some other noise. That's what that quote was from that Polynesian navigator that we talked about.
His confidence came from memory and the things that he knew. I don't know that you'd describe him as immutable truths, but he knew what he knew what he knew because his father knew what he knew what he knew, because his grandfather knew what he knew what he knew,
right.
And he could always go from one island to the next following the rules that he had learned. If you ignore the rules, you're lost at sea. If you don't pay attention to your instruments and you decide to work off of strictly the emotion of the moment, this is a JFK Jr. moment. These are the times when you do return to the fundamentals and say, listen, has anything changed?
Right.
Essentially nothing.
Well, David, with all this in mind, you know, the conferences, the overwhelming favorite part of the conferences, both Orlando and Phoenix, were the Q&As. This is when people can stand up and get their questions answered. And I know not everybody can make these conferences physically, and so you're opening up an opportunity Thursday night at 5 o'clock Pacific time, 8 o'clock Eastern time, to get their questions answered, Q&A, right on the phone.
Well, that's exactly right. We'll take about 5-10 minutes of just a preview, cover some basic issues, and then we'll open up for Q&A. It's a moderated thing, so you ask the question offline, the moderator comes on, asks the question, and then I proceed with an answer, and we move to the next. We had scheduled about 30 or 45 minutes. Last time we did this in June, it was fantastic. It went about 2.5 hours. Of course, not everyone stayed on, but we had close to 1,000 people on that wanted their questions answered, and we took as many of those questions as we could. Very fruitful. If you have some specifics that you'd like to dig into, we'd love to hear them.
Yeah, and it's important that they register ahead of time. If you're listening to this and you think you want to listen to David and ask questions, you have to register, and there's a website to go to, and we will post that on McIlvaney.com or McIlvaneyWeeklyCommentary.com. Both of those sites will have the link for registration to the Q&A Thursday night, February 21st. So, David, this is a perfect opportunity for people to ask the questions that they have for you. Again, that's Thursday night, 5 o'clock Pacific time, 8 o'clock Eastern time, and that's on February the 21st. That's Thursday night.
We'll look forward to it.
Yeah. Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.